And why try to fix something that's not broken from a business process standpoint? If you try to fix it because of a vulnerability, you may actually end up breaking, you will end up breaking someone's business.
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial? It's time to get adversarial.
Hey guys, good to see both of you. Nice to be back on the air. It's been a little bit now. I know I've done some travel lately. It looks like you guys are getting to stay put for a little bit. Is that true, Sunil, maybe?
No, headed to Tampa
there it is.
This week, and then off to Tel Aviv for a couple weeks. So it'll be picking up, at least with the peace treaty in effect of sorts. It should hopefully make it a little easier to fly in and out.
But you know what? I was looking at the news today and they were showing Gazans from the south marching up the sandy beach road to back north like, oh, cool. Now it's time we can go back and check our property. And the hostages haven't even been released yet. Like, I would hold off on that one. I'm not banking on everything being done yet. I'm glad you're not going to fly for a week. Well, I visited Singapore and I flew through Seoul to do that. And so I'm pretty much an expert on Korea now. I spent at least like 3, maybe 4 hours in the airport in either direction. I mentioned this when we were syncing up earlier, and you asked something about K-pop, and I'll tell you, it was funny. By the time I hit the ground and all the way through hanging out in Seoul and then flying into Singapore, and for like the next 48 hours, I had K-pop Demon Hunters in my head, and I didn't hear it even once in Korea. It was just that I remembered and thought about it when I landed because of my kids and started thinking and imagining it, and I just superimposed it on the entire nation. So I can't say that it's playing everywhere in Korea. Sorry to disappoint everybody.
It's similar to Salzburg, Austria. If you go to Salzburg, of course, all of us think, you know, sound of music. The hills are alive with the sound of music.
It's happened.
All the natives there are like, we hate the sound of music.
Yeah. How about you, Mari? You holding it down?
Yeah. You know, just here in the war zone that we call San Francisco. Joking. It's peaceful here. You know, I go to work Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursdays. We all go to work. We work in the office Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursdays, remote on the other days. Just traffic is starting to just, and it's not just me. I've talked to people. And I overhear conversations. I'm snoop conversations. What a snooper.
But you live in town. Anyway. Are you having to go far or is it just when you're in Sonoma?
No, I'm just from one side of the city to the other side, man. It's just traffic. All I'm saying is traffic in San Francisco is looking like pre-COVID times. There is definitely stuff is buzzing. We've been talking, you know, everybody talks about the dread of San Francisco. Nobody's here anymore, blah, blah, blah. It is just so different. And now what we hear is, oh, there's another bubble. It's the AI, the bubble of the greatest bubble of all times. Right. And so now they're saying that. But San Francisco is pretty alive.
Good. Okay. Awesome. Well, I know I'm going to be back there in the spring, so I'm glad to hear that. And man, I'm not going to get in a car anywhere. Well, I'll get in the Waymo. I love those things.
Yes.
But otherwise, I'm going to scooter around there, bike my way, and then it's great, right? No problem. Well, cool. Let's get to the news. So, Cyberness, as always, there's stuff going on. I saw a couple of articles that harken back to this Oracle CVE. I'll never remember the name. Watchtower was one of the ones who released it. I've been paying attention to those guys lately, and you know, they do like manual probing for vulnerabilities and all that. But looking at their research and all that, I was like, oh, I get it. They probably just have a few people that are really freaking good at exploiting these things, and that's what happened with this Oracle write-up that they did. And I mean, it's one of those like hit the HTTP listener and do this. Like it starts with a post and on and on. So it's involves layer 7 access to the thing. It's pre-auth. My takeaway when I read about this, about any of these legacy weirdo products from Oracle or IBM or SAP, or you know, the products where you could tell that they think it's really neat that they stood up an HTTP server, like that was new for that group. And wow, look, we got COBOL to run under a web daemon or whatever. All that stuff, like, I'm not going to fight it. I get it. It costs a fortune, and I'd have a horse's head in my bed tomorrow if I interrupted any of your business. But don't put that on the internet, right? I mean, you can't have these things on the internet and try to keep up with patching, right?
Well, or rather, if you are going to put it on the internet, at least apply the one of the basic principles that we I'll talk about with limiting, not assuming that reachability means that you are authorized to access it. And so if there's some sort of access proxy that you can put in front of it, that seems like, step one or step zero, perhaps, in some of these things.
Yeah,
and I tried not to use the word, if you know what word I'm referring to.
The trust. The trust. Yeah, no, that's right. But the thing is, like,
in front of it.
what people need to be careful about is that, like, so you put in this web server and you have it in a demo environment and you just touch it and you don't have to authenticate and you're like, okay, this is cool. Before we put it on the internet, we're going to add authentication. And so now when you hit it, there's a login screen. That's not enough, right? This is a pre-auth RCE. Assume if you can get to that web daemon that you can pop it and get root. Just assume that. Like, this is the same thing you just said, Sunil, but put in another way of saying it. You need to auth at a band, so to speak. And even adding an IDP and, like, going through Okta isn't enough. Like, you get to the login page, the login, and it redirects you to Okta. That's great, but you already popped it if there's an RCE pre-auth. So it needs to be... God, I almost said the ZT word. Hell, use a VPN, like a real VPN, like if you have to.
You mean like a Fortinet one?
Goodness. Oh, my sure. Goodness.
A Netscaler sure. VPN?
A Netscaler, all the ones that have holes in them, but at least you're hopefully checking the attack surface and reading the news on that. You're not going to be able to keep up with the every Oracle e-business patches. Like, come on. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the other consideration from a business standpoint is, I personally have never used the product, so I don't know if it has this particular use case, but I can guess it probably does, which is, hey, if you're a vendor, go access this page and register.
Extranet.
Yeah. And so essentially, you have to, there are elements of this suite that probably require unauthenticated access because you're asking your vendors or somebody to go in and put something in on their own behalf. And so you just have to expose it in some way. That said, I think one can argue you designed it wrong in some respects, there's probably better business workflows to incorporate there. But that said, that's certainly a case that I've seen or use case I've seen where having open access is required.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. And I think that, like, what we just said needs to be the argument for when they're pushing back on the no, that can't go forward because... until we have a basically a reverse proxy in front of it, like, mm-hmm. Right?
That's right.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of these, right? I mean, whether it's the Oracle,
no, right.
You mentioned the, I think you mentioned this old pattern, and the pattern that I think we saw with this one was you have to point it to port 8000, which perhaps in and of itself is an indicator of an antiquated architecture or design that is worth evaluating whether it should be out there as a part of your attack surface that you just leave unmitigated.
Yeah, well, actually, I remember specifically working with Oracle. I don't know if it was called eBusiness or whatever. It probably was the same code base. And I remember them appending :443 to the end of all the HTTPS URLs. I'm like, all right, guys, that's enough of that. You don't have to do that now. And then I think it was DLP didn't like that in the URL, and so we couldn't exempt them from the whatever the hell awful thing they needed to be exempted from. And we wanted to get them to just change the code to remove that, the port number, like, we don't need that. And they couldn't do it. Like, the whole organization couldn't do something like that. So, yeah, it's a little bit antiquated.
It's interesting. I did a quick research. You know, we talked about things that move the needle. I know we have a space. We're going to talk about that real shortly. But we talked about bounty programs. And, you know, I'm like, if you're going to put an application like that on the internet, it would be probably in Oracle's best interest or any vendor's best interest. This is where you throw in stuff like bug bounty programs. So I quickly looked at Oracle to say, do they have a bug bounty program? And they do. And they actually have steps on how to use even Oracle Identity Cloud Service for a single sign-on for people in the Hacker One program to do this. There's something amiss here. I don't know how popular this application is. That they have, I have really, I don't really know Oracle that much. Well, thank the Lord.
I mean, but a bug finding program isn't a silver bullet either. In terms of, you know, you're still going to find things that are missed through even thousands of eyes.
Totally.
So, but I remember Mary Davidson way back in the day. She was very hostile to any sort of disclosures of vulnerabilities inside their application suite. She's moved. I don't know if she's still part of it. But anyway, she's, you know, other people have taken over the role now. My friend Rob Duhart now is the CSO, I think, of Oracle. So I think this is under his remit. He just recently took on the CSO role from the CISO role. So I guess he's in charge of physical security. And my joke to Rob was, does that mean you get to also do physical security for a certain island in Hawaii?
I'm not getting it.
Larry Ellison owns
cool.
Lanai, I think. Or like 97% of Lanai or something like that.
Yeah. I didn't know that. Yeah.
So doing physical security for Allison would be a nice job.
That wouldn't be bad at all. Yeah.
And his buddy Zuckerberg sits on the other island. It's really nice. His billionaires, you know.
But anyway, well, that's it. They have a bug. Even if they had a bug bounty, it's not going to necessarily cover everything, right?
But I got it. It wouldn't be good enough. But at least it finds some things like, you know, again, thinking about Snowflake. You had a logging page and that was it. And you had credentials to get in. Okay, how you get credentials, that's a different story. But leaving this stuff like that, if this is if I'm looking at this right, this is a business application, has access to a lot of different things. You don't want to have unauthenticated access to some of these things, right? You want to authenticate and then get in and then do some more things. And
there's a little bit of history on some of these that are really interesting to consider. So, SAP is I'm more aware of the issues of SAP, but you have these large systems that help run a business. And once you're on the system, you're kind of locked in. It's really hard for you to move off of those systems because it is like your key thing that you run your business on. And so there's a reason why a lot of these apps just stay there for a long time and why they are such a choice target for attackers, because you do take out these systems and now the business just comes to a crawl, you know, to a halt. So anyway, It's a hard challenge to even migrate off of them. It's a hard challenge to secure them because people don't want, you know, why try to fix something that's not broken from a business process standpoint? If you try to fix it because of a vulnerability, you may actually end up breaking. You will end up breaking someone's business, and that has its own sort of blowback. So anyway, I can appreciate the challenges of fixing some of these longstanding things.
Yeah, I mean, I think like to a layperson or a CFO, you know, they hear the marketing. And it's like there's four cloud providers, and there's Amazon and Microsoft and Google and Oracle, and why not? Sure, yeah. And it's a technology company. It's big. It's got a massive market cap, dude. Owns Lanai apparently, and on. But like, it's very different, right? Do you know what WebDaemon like GCP is running for their admin interface? Like, is it Nginx? Is it? I don't know offhand, but it's either their bespoke thing or it's open source or probably both. It's probably on the latest rev. It probably changes rev every 18 hours and gets upgraded. Like, they own that and it's optimized. Do you know what WebDaemon is on, whatever the hell this Oracle thing is? It's the one that got minted for you as a customer 18 months ago when they stood up your instance. It's, they call it cloud. It's not cloud. It's an old school data center with 4,500 unique forked instances of whatever Java software the dudes rolled 6 years ago. It's not cool and not safe. But again, I don't want the horse's head in my bed, but you got to put a reverse proxy in front of the thing, and then we can all just pretend that it's great, if that's what we got to do, right? All right, moving on. A little bit opinionated there. The Jaguar Land Rover thing, it's early October, and I checked the headlines this morning and I heard that production was finally going to start, but, you know, it still hadn't completely started. So it might just go on.
Wait, is that serious? I mean, they had not been able
over a month.
Over a month.
Mm-hmm. And the local articles about the financial impact focus a lot on the supply chain. And there's a lot of like really rough stories out of these independent, small Midlands, UK companies that haven't been able to ship, no less get paid for a long time. And so the UK government, by the way, part of the story in there was that they're not going to be able to make a claim because they don't have insurance. And that comes out of supposedly they were like in negotiations to get cyber insurance and then decided, nah, let's not do it. The premium's too high. So, which means insurers are pretty damn good nowadays.
Jaguar Land Rover could not pay the insurance. Is that what you're saying?
No, no. Their didn't get insurance. So they're going to be on the hook for whatever it is that's the cost of this. They're not going to be able to insure to risk transfer and to do an insurance claim. And so they get this loan from the UK government, $2 billion, to help with that. And one of the things I heard that JLR was talking about doing was like using that to basically help the supply chain. And to do it by, you know how these things are, it's like whatever the payment terms are, and it's JLR, I bet it's 60 or 90 days. And that means they pay you on day 60 or day 90 and not a moment sooner than that. And so they're going to accelerate the payments so that when they get the order flow going again, now these guys don't have to wait for the whole net 90 or whatever it is on top of waiting this month. So that's nice. But man, this is insanity. This is over 5 weeks of assembly lines stopped. And I still haven't been able to get confirmation on whether it was actual destructive ransom or sabotage or wiper or ransomware, or if it was an own goal and they preemptively shut things down to be safe or some combination of those or anything else like that. But this is going to be a really interesting one to follow. Hopefully that some good intel comes out of it or maybe a responder report on this thing.
So on this one, the interesting thing about this is not just strictly the ransomware attack, not just strictly that they were down, but that the payment or their ability to recover, because of their lack of ability to recover effectively, they had to get a loan, and the loan itself was backed by the UK government. I'm gonna state it this way, and it's a little bit of a stretch to state it this way, but bear with me as I make
stretch
a
case it, Sunil. Stretch
here,
it.
That the UK government bailed out Land Rover, Jaguar Land Rover, by paying the ransom or doing something. They didn't quite pay the ransom, but it's like paying the ransom. Okay, it didn't pay the ransom, but I'm just saying it's like paying the ransom. And what is interesting is because it's similar to a recent event where you have Scattered Spider basically now saying, "Hey, Salesforce, all those customers that we popped, all your customers that we popped, we're about to release all their data." And maybe you can pay up to avoid paying on their behalf. So it's a sort of, it isn't, again, it's a little bit of a stretch, but there's a similar sort of pattern that's unfolding here. In the event, let's just, I'm gonna play out a scenario that may, I hope doesn't happen, but could happen, okay? A whole bunch of critical infrastructures in the US get hit by the same actor. And the actor says, "Hey, look, you know, each of these different entities can pay up, or U.S. government, why don't you just come in and just, you know, put some numbers here, and we'll just have it all go away for you," right? And it's an interesting proposition, and one that Salesforce is basically saying, "No, screw you, go away." But I can imagine some scenarios where that could be a pretty compelling argument to make from the attacker standpoint, and I'm not sure exactly how this is going to unfold on the Salesforce side, because I think that the attackers were supposed to leak this data today, as of this recording. But I can also imagine a scenario where Salesforce says, "Hey, you could have stopped this, and you didn't. So it doesn't seem like you really have our back. Where's the shared responsibility on this, if there is any?"
Yeah, but I mean, it's an interesting point, right? So Salesforce kind of has their cake and eat it too here, because they get to take the high ground, the moral high ground of not paying the ransom, but they're also completely up. They haven't had a compromise. They don't have an exploit. So it's kind of easy for them. Sales Loft, on the other hand, actually had a security issue. I got to assume they got that letter too. Like, hey, Sales Loft, why don't you pay for everybody? So that's another headline we need to talk about when it comes out. But for Salesforce, I'm not too surprised. And but just to be clear, the JLR thing, as far as I know, we don't know there's an extortion attempt yet. You know, stands to some reason, I guess. And who knows, maybe they pissed off North Korea, right? It could be Wiper for all we know, right? We'll see. But let's talk about the government paying these ransoms. I mean, first of all, I don't think they would. I think the government's been extorted a billion times over when it comes to kidnappings and geopolitics, and there's all kinds of opportunity to pay. And they've got all these fighter jets. So I think that's their next move if somebody said, if they care enough, because critical infrastructure and macroeconomics are affected, then I think that's their nuclear option.
Because I guess I work for startups and I like startups and I love the disruption nature of startups and capitalism, right? Companies don't have to live forever. If their technology, if they don't grow, they don't continue to grow with the times, then they should be, I'm sorry, decimated. And I'm going to try to make a connection here. Oracle, when you have a very closed system, not very competitive, because people, like you said, once they invest in these systems, it's really hard to take them out, especially if they're in the manufacturing, they're part of your business. There's not a lot of push for pushing more creativity, for pushing newer technologies, because you got them locked in. I think this Land Rovers, honestly, I thought they went bankrupt years ago. And so right now, I thought they did, right? And then they bought by somebody else. Maybe I'm completely wrong. Maybe I'm confusing them with Jaguar. But there's just, again, these are companies. I get the association to the UK makes, I get it. But if it's not succeeding in the business, it should just die. Die. Go get a new company, build something different and replace it. And I think some of these things we're looking at is older technology. Maybe you're not getting the right talent. Maybe you're not investing in the right places. And this is a result of that. Now, I'm not saying this about Salesforce. I'm talking about the other two companies.
Cold-blooded.
I mean, right? Go ahead, Sunil.
Well, at the end of the day, however they recover from this, there's obviously lots of lessons learned, and moreover, one would hope that their actual production facilities and such become much more efficient because they've had the opportunity to truly like reset things and to build it in a way that is that's more modern.
Yeah. 30 days, more than 30 days, right? More than 30 days.
Oh, yeah. Rolling past 30 days. Yeah. So we'll see about that.
And going back to dropping a bomb on somebody, there's certainly physical effects and such. But when you're dealing with criminal actors, anyway, when you're dealing with this type of behavior, which and your economies, when you have certain things on the line that make it really hard for you to sustain this position of not budging and not negotiating with terrorists, so to speak, it's a hard statement. It's hard to make that argument when in a scenario where you have your economy failing rapidly, and in this case with JLR, it's within a specific part of the UK. But imagine again if there was a scenario that was more widespread. And under what conditions might the U.S. government cave? Okay, again, hopefully we don't see this sort of situation. But you can imagine a situation where if you had many infrastructures held hostage by a threat actor, then the scenario of the an easier way out could be made available. And here you go, pay it on behalf of all these folks. Does that invite more attacks in the future? Probably. Okay. But someone who can pull that off across multiple critical infrastructures.
Supporting me, Sunil. I mean, this has been my big argument for years with Jerry. Jerry says, don't pay the ransomwares. Don't pay the bad guys.
Everybody
agrees not to do that, make it illegal. And I said, and I've said it multiple times, the minute one of these companies or people or local constituents goes to these politicians and says, I've lost jobs, I can't pay the bills, go pay that ransomware, politicians are just going to fall over, roll over. I don't know. By the way, I don't know if these guys are paying any ransomware. But again, I don't think we have a backbone.
And I read this article, you know, I feel differently about it. But when I read the JLR stuff, I just think, man, assuming it turned out to be ransomware, then I just can't help but think, like, this wouldn't have happened if ransomware payments had been banned 18 months ago. Yeah.
As long as you have companies who are being, you know, floated by their own governments because they want to keep their citizens employed, and these companies are not surviving on their own, their technology is weak sauce, it's not keeping up with the newer stuff, they shouldn't be around. You got this is what free market is all about. Go startups.
All right. We did the we introduced the move the needle topic last time. Doesn't mean it's gonna be around forever, but we didn't get through all of them. So I was thinking we would talk a little more about that, and had a few discussions spin out from that. Some people react to that. So I want to get back into that again. I want to have some fun with that. I'll introduce the first one here, and then you guys can jump in and see if you agree or disagree. I think, when it comes to, again, to introduce this, is companies who made a difference in cybersecurity, specifically in making things more secure, not just about generating money or anything like that. When I started brainstorming on that, one of the ones that came to my mind was Gmail. And the thought was, I mean, there's a number of things that they've done really well, but if you just even try to send good old-fashioned malware in the way that used to just crush everybody 20 years ago, there used to be so many different email platforms too. And everyone had different levels of controls and settings and all that. And now it's like, God knows what, but maybe 55% of the humans are on a Google-related platform, and they all inherit the exact same control stack. And kudos to Google for saying, now that you're all on one stack, we're actually going to put some controls in it. I mean, it took a lot to be able to say, well, you can't send an EXE file to, 600 million people, right? I mean, there's lesser things that we're not willing to do because it might affect 1,000 people, and they were willing to make some calls like that. So I think that made a huge difference. I mean, you can't do phishing the way you used to when it came to like sending malware. And we still talk about it. We still train people, of course, because no before is frozen time. Like, we probably educate people every single day to not execute an attachment, an email. And it's kind of impossible to even do that, though, thanks to Gmail. And
wasn't, I guess. Wasn't Pustini, I thought Pustini was an acquisition that Google did for Gmail back in the 2000s. Oh. Yes, it was Pustini.
I remember Pustini fact, on their own. Okay.
Yeah. In fact, I interviewed for them back in those days.
Yeah. So maybe they're the ones who get the credit. There are other companies in here. You know, Sassy or whatever it is world, like, proxies in general, and some people have heard me rail about proxies for years. I was always like a DNS filtering kind of guy. But Blue Coat is a household name, certainly was, probably created the proxy market and owned it really well, very good at capitalizing on that. Very successful company. If they had never been around, I don't think it would have hurt a thing security-wise. Mm. I mean, there's some cool controls you could do in proxies, but everywhere I went, it wasn't fully deployed. There was exceptions around it. Didn't work, so you had to immediately.
It was buggy as heck when I first deployed it in the old, like, back when it started.
Or you got it working, but it sure as hell wasn't doing TLS inspection. Probably didn't have 90% of the buttons turned on because it would ruin the enterprise every time that someone tried it. I don't know. I think just DNS filtering, most people would be fine. I don't know. You worked at proxy orgs, right? I know you did, Sunil and Mario. Did you guys use proxy servers? And
I won't say they saved my bacon, but no, I've even worked on F5s myself and Blue Coat and all of these. And I went back to the same place you went, Jerry. I hate to say it, DNS.
Oh, which is basically free.
Yeah, that's exactly, because what am I going to do? I mean, every time I freaking decrypted, we talked about this multiple times, you decrypt a TLS tunnel. Oh, great, look at what I can see. And then you're like, I don't know what I'm doing. There's so much information, right?
Right. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think Blue Coat certainly moved the needle in a couple ways, but maybe in ways that we may not necessarily always fully appreciate or want. If I recall, there was a news article way back in the day about Blue Coat's collaboration with the Chinese government and how a lot of the features around blocking of content came from what they learned from the Chinese government and what the Chinese government wanted to do at scale as a part of their Great Firewall. So what I find interesting about some of these technologies, at least the ones that you talk about that move the needle, a lot of it is about how do you take the controls that you'd want to implement in an authoritarian state and make it suitable for an enterprise. So anyway, with that framing, some of these move the needle.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm still not into the proxies. And then also it was like, oh, you need to have everybody in the entire global enterprise reroute all their HTTP traffic to where the hell we have the racked up Blue Coats. And so there added latency and your location services were off. And that's why
I think, going back to, and the reason why I made the comment about the authoritarian states is because we also have this massive driver in the internet engineering community that want to defeat some of these controls, right? Mm-hmm. They're explicitly trying to avoid situations where you can actually monitor and get any value mm-hmm. out of them.
And you're talking about organizations like Google, like they're the ones that are funding and trying to avoid TLS interception.
Yeah, Google, so I think there's an interesting battle that's unfolding between two different sides. You know, essentially, you can think of it as privacy and
security.
I'll put an authoritarian form of security on the other end, right? And whether it plays out in a geopolitical standpoint or it plays out inside of an enterprise, we have that playing out on a regular basis. And so the question in terms of moving the needle is really a question of moving the needle towards what? More authoritarian security or more towards privacy? And I think part of what we would also want to understand is what direction do we actually want to move it in? Because in some respects, there are very good reasons why we want to move it towards privacy and not make tools like Blue Coat work anymore.
I want to connect on stuff to just continue this whole TLS and SSL and what moved the needle. And I was just doing some research to double check my memory because it's getting kind of worse as I get older. But I want to say RSA/VeriSign moved the needle when it came to SSL. Providing certificate authorities to allow to encrypt a lot. You know, if you look back in 19, but by the way, and I just checked, VeriSign came from RSA, just for the record. And they got spun off in 1995. And you know what also came out in 1995? Netscape's Navigator released SSL 2.0, which was very vulnerable to man-in-the-middle attacks. We all know about that sort of stuff. All I'm trying to convey to you folks is, you know, the world of encrypting our traffic. Most of the traffic back in 95 was HTTP. And it was until these guys started creating a commercial space where you have browsers who can support SSL. And then you also had the companies. RSA spun off VeriSign because it was, I mean, obviously a good, juicy new business for these guys to focus on. And they started providing the most viable commercial certificate authority services back in those days.
Well, what moved the needle there was not necessarily just them creating those protocols for just because, but rather because we actually wanted to conduct transactions and banking transactions over that. And there's no way you could do that without having the proper levels of encryption.
Totally. Yeah. Totally.
But, you know, I would argue, like, to call out specific names to it, the network solutions and then VeriSign and the certificate authorities that were public and that you would have to go to get www.company.com and get a certificate for. Great. They allowed, to Sunil's point, they allowed the protocol evolution to manifest and do it quick. But RSA, I remember specifically, they made a whole suite of, I can almost remember the name of it, of PKI products for like on-prem certificate authorities, on-prem. And not just SSL, but anything with cryptography and signing and verification. And I'm sorry, that didn't move a damn thing. I mean, you go back in time and just burn that all
for
down.
For internal?
Yeah.
Well, no, so it didn't get, I think you're talking about Suite B, but I think that most of that didn't work inside of enterprise. It definitely, there were mandates within DoD and military entities that had to implement those.
I think OpenSSL moved the needle from open source to doing that, providing those services
internally.
There you internally.
Go. Totally agree.
Right? And then you have micro, and if you want to look at an enterprise, here's somebody, Microsoft, and their search services. So whatever you want to say about Microsoft, I cannot believe I'm saying this, but they really did do a good job of implementing certificate authorities and certificates for laptops, and not just users, but for laptops and endpoints, and integrated in Active Directory in a very seamless and easy way to get it done. And this is back in 2002, 2003. And I think that made it, that and openness. So one is open source, the other one's commercial, is my point.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, like, the commercial products, and it was like SAP or something, like they would walk into a company and sell a package for, you know, $500,000 or more. And it was, you know, it's a classic recipe. We've seen it a million times. It's going to take you 6 years to implement this.
Yep.
Everybody's going to change direction in 4 years. They're never going to figure out the emperor had no clothes, and we're going to make a bunch of money. And by the way, the big four is going to come in too, because you need them to implement it. And there's going to be 48 strangers in cubicles for 6 years, and nothing's going to get done. And that's how the commercial in-house PKI solutions were. And you're going to have that. And then they would have like thick clients that would actually, like, you know, check out keys, and all that stuff was just a big, I don't know, of a kosher word to say to describe a wasted set of activity. But
back
no,
in 98,
I don't add to the thing.
Back in 98, 99, when I worked at EY, we did an implementation of Netscape CA services, and it was over $1 million.
Yeah. Right? Is that project done yet?
You know who that company was that we deployed it for?
Oh, I like it. Statute of limitations is gone.
Amazon. Kid you not.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, they wanted to sell books. Hey, before we get off this topic, a good one for today. Zscaler, though. Everybody's run a Zscaler. I bet 70% of our listening audience is. They've sold a lot of stuff in the name of solving the internet security. Have they done it?
What, solved internet security? No. Let me check. Nope. No, they haven't.
Well, use my litmus test. You go back in time and they're not around. Are we in better, worse, or no different?
Let me walk you through a framework, first of all. So the question in terms of what moves the needle, I think one of the key questions I think through is there are four stages through which we see different types of problems emerge in any ecosystem. And the four stages is based on this model called the Kinefin model. It's pronounced Kinefin, but it's spelled Cynefin. And it goes through four stages: chaotic, complex, complicated, clear. And things just move through this sort of pattern. So the web comes out and things are chaos. Eventually we figure out a way to manage it, or at least understand how to risk manage it. And so we're in complex. Eventually we end up with technologies that enable us to automate some of these processes, but they're very complicated. And then eventually it becomes clear. So encryption being one of those things that, PKI was one of those situations where it was complex, became complicated, And tools like Let's Encrypt actually made it super clear, okay? And so each of these different stages, you could argue from complex to complicated and from complicated to clear is where the needle was moved, okay? And so I think of it in terms of, let's say, Blue Coat made it go from complex to complicated.
Chaotic to complex, maybe. One of those, okay.
But then Zscaler made it from complicated to clear.
Yeah.
I don't think it's clear.
I'm not saying I'm a proponent of Zscaler, but would you guys agree that one of the reasons we use less and less VPNs is because Zscaler has made it easier to use, have to use VPNs? You can get access to things that are to be protected. Now you can go via HTTPS, get in front of it, put some, I know, mutual TLS authentication. I know we don't want to talk about zero trust, but they've done a good job there, guys. And I think that's why VPNs are going down. It's in the data.
Yeah, I like, well, I think you're right that that's something valuable they did. I think on the and see, you know, you got me thinking, like, maybe even if something, in my opinion at least, didn't end in generating any help, maybe it was a necessary step along the way, and therefore I shouldn't poo-poo on them. Maybe I'll think about that philosophically. I'm drinking tea. But
is but it the I funny think, kind of tea?
No, I was thinking of just senile tea. Yeah. But like the thing that gets me though is like I think that whole pathway of like someone early on decided in order to protect your endpoint, you need to route all of their internet surfing through a control point where you can adjudicate it. And now we have within that constraint, this evolution from perhaps chaotic to complicated. But I don't like the whole paradigm to begin with. And so I feel like we're just going deeper and deeper, but there's a fundamental issue with that. So it used to suck because you expected everybody in the world to route their traffic through your blue coat proxies in Detroit, which also just went down last night. And now every time you have a problem, slowness, misconfig, you have another remote office that breaks the chain and gets off of it and gets off of it. And that's the problem. And now at Zscaler, we're going to make your office in Singapore route through. Maybe it's not Detroit, but it's still a pain. And you're still, and it's even worse now because of location services. And so again, you have all these individual apps, teams, combinations of them, identity-based, that get a workaround, that get to avoid ZIA and on. And that's just explosive. Like there's no point in having it all. Like it's better to have a mediocre control that has ubiquitous coverage than to have this utopian control that is only in place 13.7% of the time, and you never know which 13.7% of assets are going to be covered with it. And that's where I think we are. Right. And most people who get sold on these, and by the way, throw Netskope in there too. I think Netskope sure. is like
well, even worse. Yeah, totally.
So I think every one of these technologies plays its sort of moves down this sort of cycle. And eventually we get to a point where we can do the best we can with that particular technology. And we all lament that is this the best we can do? Right.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. So someone creative comes around and says, well, gee, instead of putting these proxies out there, why don't we just bake it into the browser itself?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then voila, you end up with Secure Enterprise Browser as a new type of solution, which right now I would still say is sort of in that complex, complicated state.
Yes.
But may eventually, you can imagine Google maybe trying to get to a point where it's just super clear inside of this just Chrome, right? It comes in built into Chrome and no one has to worry about having to tack it on after the fact.
Yeah.
But the point is that in each of these cycles, we'll end up with this perspective of, we'll get to a point where it's easy, super easy to implement because it's now clear. MFA is an example of that, where I think MFA is super easy to implement. Eventually someone's going to say, dang, MFA still sucks. Can we do something better than that? Like, I don't know, passkey.
Oh, you're right. I think, like, not to over harp on the specifics of it, but, you know, I think that's really actually good. I think backhauling traffic is just bad. If you're going to embrace the internet and you're going to have people in your company working from anywhere in the world, and if you're going to go hybrid, if you're going to go remote, if you're going to have a lot of offices, then let them use the internet. And if they're working for you and they're in Wichita or in Kuala Lumpur and they go to YouTube, they damn well should go to YouTube, and they should take advantage of the unicast network and the CDNs and the billions of dollars, maybe trillions, that we've put into this collective infrastructure. If instead you think you're going to send them back to New York to run through, or including Zscaler's POP, even if that's in Singapore or wherever it is, it's not going to work. It's going to bust on you. Dropping to the browser, it solves that. It fits in the paradigm I'm introducing. You stick on the endpoint, let them egress, let them take advantage of their internet connection. Browser's good. I'm a fan of that model too. Also DNS-based filtering. I just check the DNS thing. Is it going to a .top domain? Kill it. Like, oh, but then you can't see what the hell's going on in there. You never could. No one is actually inspecting. You know, if I'm setting up a malware or a C2 site or an exfiltration site, it takes like 30 minutes to make sure it can ever be broken, right? And it could not only be like HSTS, it could also be put it in the financial services category and all the cowards at the company think you can't break TLS on that. It's but just you, silly.
Let me try to connect one thing that you said, Jerry. You were saying that, okay, and again, I'm not a proponent of Zscaler, but I would like to understand of the customers that are Zscalers, how many of them are actually having real successful breaches that have impacted their company? I don't know that, but I would like to understand that. But I think what you brought up, Jerry, was something along the lines of, well, you're only covering 30%, you're not doing the whole, if you don't cover the entire maybe endpoint population, then it's not worth it, right? You're not going to be able to really have protection. I think you mentioned something like,
It harkens to, I'm going to let you continue to say, but it harkens to our downgrade attack thing, right? Where I'm just saying like...
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. So I think, I mean, I would add, you know, yes, if you deploy it to all endpoints, why wouldn't that help? And then I would like to understand, does Zscaler clients experience at the average company out there, and Sunil is going to throw some freaking crazy science number where the typical company that gets major data breaches over 1 million records a year, it's very, very small, he's going to tell us, right? So does Zscaler really move the needle, in other words, if you deploy it across all the enterprise? And what does
that look
like?
If you deploy it, because the whole point of the segment is all things included, does it actually move the needle, meaning... is it normally fully deployed? Are all the buttons turned on? Hell no, in Zscaler.
That's correct.
Does anyone even work there that knows where the buttons are? You know, it's like all our security tools. Somebody turned on everything the first day, broke everything, shut down the company, got their tail between their legs, turned everything off, and never looked back.
That's correct. I just went through a tool that is supposed to be monitoring on what applications we install. And it was, you know, by default, I'm using an MSSP and they installed this tool. I'm not going to name them. I don't want to badmouth them. But the idea is one of these white application listing, right? You say
application only wireless.
I called that MSSP last night and I said, take it off my entire fleet. Are you crazy? I don't want it. Just get it off. It's more headache than it's worth. Right now, we're too small of a company. There's a lot of creation,
you downgraded.
New applications. Exactly. I don't know if I downgrade. In fact, I think I upgrade it. I make things easier.
Well, let me put that a different way. If you were strategically looking about the ways to secure a small company, and one of them was application whitelisting, and the other was, well, application whitelisting is too heavy. Instead, let's run some EPP, some heuristic endpoint protection. And if you chose the former and you said we're going to application whitelist, then what had just happened to Mario is a downgrade attack because you chose what you thought was stronger and you ended up with what was weaker because when you turned it off, you'd had none of the above. Whereas if you pick something that's not perfect but will stay on, it's a much better play. Like DNS filtering.
Correct. I mean, I would argue, you know, CrowdStrike, you're using MFA with FIDO2, you're using a secure or enterprise browser, and you get rid of passwords to authenticate. You kind of, you know, and you have some anti-phishing, make it harder on people in your Gmail account. You know what I mean? It reduces your footprint and for an attacker to gain access to your environment.
Absolutely.
Plus, take advantage of it when you're a small company. You're not getting the attention from the big boys, the bad boys.
Yeah, right. All right. So some article came out about 12 security problems practitioners want solved. And we were batting that around and talking about, I think that's really important, right? Whether we're talking about our investment segment and what people should build or invest in next, or whether we're talking about controls. Any of these stand out to either of you that resonated with you?
One stands out only because it happens to align with what Nostic is doing. It was among the list of things that mentioned was semantically aware access control or access management, and the basic premise is that we want to say, let's say we have one of the rule that says allow sales reps in the Northwest to only access the data that they're supposed to have access to, or rather, just even more generically, allow people to only have access that they should have access to, and you know, something of that sort that you can generically state, but the implementation of that requires it to be translated or adjusted into all of these different sort of systems. And right now, that's a huge challenge for a lot of us. One of the things that we're starting to see with large language models is the ability to actually express that statement and then have it find ways to apply those controls that is adapt it to each of these different platforms. Anyway, so that one resonated with me. But overall, though, I actually thought that the asks, the things that we in security want to wish that could be solved, I thought was actually somewhat unrealistic. Because it really, in many cases, the problem that needs to be solved is not a security problem, but a business problem. Gene Spafford, he had this quote. I'm gonna summarize it, but he's, you know, the question was, "What's the most secure computer?" And Gene Spaff said, "If the most secure computer is one that you put in a block of concrete, line it with lead, put chains around it, stick it in the bottom of the ocean." And he said, "Even with that, I'm not sure if they'll be secure." Okay, well, we all know that if you had such a system, it'd also be entirely unusable, right? And so I think the reality is that, yes, we want these problems to be solved. We want everything to be patched or fixed from day one, or we want secure defaults. But let me take the secure defaults one just as an example. The reality is the fact that you even have an option for a setting, right? The fact that you can choose something implies that there's a legitimate reason why the other choice, the non-secure choice, the choice that we think is not secure, there's a legitimate business reason for that choice. And so if you choose, if you force everyone down a particular path, you ultimately break different parts of the business, and it becomes a business, both an operational risk from the business standpoint, more so a risk from the business standpoint. And so anyway, bottom line is that these are not necessarily security problems as much as they're business problems. And because of that, I don't know if these are necessarily ever going to be solvable.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, like, I think Justin's point, it was Justin Pagano who wrote the piece that you were talking about, GRC engineer, I'll call him, because he does a really good job of getting that community together, which to me is basically like, imagine if GRC was good and effective. So it's awesome. Huh. But right, I mean, I think he does make a point that by, I'll call it principle versus prescriptive access control. And what he's basically saying is like, instead of having to define the entities and the vocabulary of a given environment and then make a Boolean statement linking those, you just say the intent, and then those should manifest as necessary in the different tools.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. Of all the ones I listed, that's the only one that I'm like, hey, I like that one. But then again, that's self-serving because that's exactly what Gnostic does.
Okay, I'm an investor in Gnostic. This is why I believe in this man's company.
Yes, but what I'm saying is that there were certain things that were just, I think, unrealistic as something that's truly solvable, because it's not a security problem to be solved. It's a business problem to be solved.
Well, if there's one that that resonated with me that I could use to self-promote, that's the new theme. There's one about vulnerability management is still broken. Like, damn right it is. It's a disaster. And I mean, I think that vulnerability management shouldn't even exist as a discipline, class, job title, department, because if you're spending any time at all focusing on just vulnerabilities to the detriment of configuration errors and regulatory findings and everything else, then it's a waste. You should apply the whatever solution is to everything. But what the speaker in this one, Randolph Barr, talked about in particular was that you're dumping too much stuff downstream on engineering, and then they push back because, and he's nice about it, he says that because it lacks context, oddish. It's because they're stupid. I mean, because the tickets are stupid, right? And the problem is, the team that gets this, and this vulnerability management team, it shouldn't be. It should be GRC. And everyone's like, whoa, no, they're only supposed to do compliance. No, the R in the middle is risk management. That's what this is. This is GRC's job. And when they take the findings from all the sources, tools, people, engagements, and push them to the remediators, which is often engineering, they're the ones who should not be pushing stupid things, because engineering knows stupid, and it busts credibility. And when you ask them to fix things that they know can't be exploited, then they start tuning out. And when you bring it up on the board and say, no, they're not really fixing stuff, then there's a whole inquisition launch. And at the end of it, they realize you issued them stupid stuff and they get the sympathy and you're the one who fails here. So I agree with him that we need to triage stuff properly and only issue tickets for things that really are worth fixing.
I want to go back to, okay, so you're a security guy. I'm gonna go and be adversarial to our engineering brothers, okay? But this is where we security can play a role. Okay. So if you have a cloud environment, I'm not going to go on-prem. I'm going to let the on-prem world live on-prem, whatever. Just go on in the cloud. You have an environment, you deploy to AWS, Azure, GCP, whatever that is. And if God bless you, if you're an Oracle. And so, right. Bless their soul, as my Southern friends would like to say, right.
Bless their heart.
Bless their heart. Thank you. Not their soul. Thank you. Thank you for correcting me. There you go. Anyway, if you're in the cloud and you have a predictable application that you're providing to as a service, a SaaS application, whatever that is, engineers need to get into the habit of immutable infrastructure. You have to get in reducing. You get these operating systems that are totally bloated. But nowadays, with a lot of these Kubernetes, a lot of these infrastructure that we can do, we can reduce how bloated those operating systems are and just get down to the very specific libraries that you need to do your job with. If you can do that, this whole vulnerability management becomes very manageable. It becomes a less cumbersome thing. But the problem is engineers don't spend enough time. They do not spend enough time in reducing those bloated operating systems, even those Kubernetes nodes.
Yeah. You're not wrong. But I mean, I think you've kind of fallen for it to some degree, though, right? Which is that we need to get all these vulns fixed. And you know what? I think it's cool to have an awful RCE, CVE on some stuff that's not exploitable, because that's a sign of efficiency and business optimization.
No, I would push back. I think that you don't need to have all those branches and unnecessary libraries. It's bloated stuff.
It's mature. You're right. I mean, it's better, but it's not. I mean, at the end of the day, I want to reduce risk, not just be on the latest.
Okay. But there are two parts of what you guys were saying. First is, if there's unnecessary attack surface, don't even include it, right? So having minimal builds, what ChainGuard does with containers or
that's Wiz is going to do it now, right?
We're starting to see that even with Docker hardened images and such, so on and so forth. But anyway, point being, minimal builds, right? Only have what you need to have. So fully in support with that. Similar principle that happens in data, like data minimization. Why have data that you don't need hanging around? But then there's another piece which I think, Jerry, you're talking about in terms of, suppose it is something that's required, but it's just not exposed in a way that people can hit it directly. Okay. So that even if it's the, 9.8 CVSS score, if it's not directly accessible, or maybe even indirectly accessible. But certainly, if it's not indirectly accessible, then it's you just you risk accept and move on. But I think the point is that most of the vulnerability management processes don't really have a good risk acceptance process.
Yep. It's not risk acceptance; it's risk downgrade. It's rescoring. You're not saying hell yeah, I take risk. You're saying that's not risky because.
Correct.
Okay, valid point. And we know in the CVSS scores there is a environmental score, which is really usually ignored. Whatever.
Because the tools that are scoring don't have any access to that.
Yeah. But the environmental score ultimately brings it down to a zero, or to the CVSS to a zero. And at that point, to your point, there is no risk acceptance. It's like, what risk are you? There is no risk.
I like to make a connection with everything we're saying, because I did want to highlight one of these ones, 12 security problems, that I think also is kind of hovering about all the stuff we're talking about here. And that's the one with context collapse, security data without actionable intelligence. Right now, we're drowning with so much security. We have security events, security, everything, notifications about our environments, everything that we probably didn't, we're probably drowning. We have more information than we did 5 years ago when it comes to security. But without any context, it becomes what is this?
Yeah.
So I would argue the problem with this is that you can't get this out of the box. This is
100%.
This is something that if you buy a SIM, stick it in, and hope that it works on day one, it's going to fail you because you've done no tuning. Okay, and the tuning. Whether it's with AI or not, at some level, you still need some form of tuning to say, this is how our business actually operates. And because this is how it operates, in other words, you as a security person need to actually provide that tuning. Hopefully the tuning is less and less, that we need to tune it less and less, but you still have to do tuning. And so I don't think going back to the ask that's here, if the ask is, hey, can I just throw this product out there and not do anything to make it work, that's not reality.
Mm-hmm. You know, we implemented, I mean, we made it super easy for engineers to do threat modeling for every feature that was at a certain level, if it was medium or high, whatever, right? Depending on the business services. You know, the threat modeling would help us then feed into what we were monitoring for potential security suspicious activities. And we spent a ton of time on this stuff, tons of it, made it super easy. And what we ended up finding out is that that threat model that we were doing, that we thought we were doing well, and that then we put in security analytics based on what was acceptable and not, was generating over 90% of our false alarms.
Yeah, I mean, I think going from a threat model is pretty hard, you know? But I think being able to figure out like where a vulnerability scanner asset is in the network and what has access to it is better. And by the way, like just to use a concrete example, if you have 10,000 nodes on your network and you scan them all, and now you've got like, let's just say you have 150 instances of like an old Chrome version. Now you're mature enough and wise enough to say like, okay, not all those are really a panic, even if they're CVSS 9.0. And I'm going to figure out some things. Where are they deployed? What are the type of users? Are they actually actively using them interactively? Do they have other compensating controls? All that kind of stuff. That's a lot of work, and it's really hard. And that's the important stuff we're talking about doing to distinguish and to differentiate. But the poor man's solution is just to shut off all the vulnerability scanners and just run a bug bounty. Because people laugh at that, like, oh, that's not the same thing. It's vulnerability scanners if you add context. And the context is you're outside the network. Like, everything from a bug bounty, you don't have to wrestle with whether or not it's internal or external, or let's recreate from Terraform in a virtual environment and see if there's internet access and check the, could they get to it from the Holiday Inn or not?
Yeah. True. Yeah.
Or attack surface management tools if you want to be a little bit deeper and more automated than bug bounty. But the same vantage point is okay, but we just feel like we have to run root level agents on everything or it's not true. And I don't know. I don't agree with that. Any other ones on here? All right. Last topic I want to talk about today. So the CISA, not the agency, but the ACT, the Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act. I remember that making the rounds back when it got instituted. I was working with FSISAC at the time a lot. And I believe I or my organization or FSISAC or whatever it was helped push this effort forward. And it's generally a good idea. But that's expired now. And the headlines are kind of saying that adversaries are licking their chops over the fact that CISA has expired because they know no one's going to share intel with the government and therefore are going to fall prey to adversaries right away. What do you guys think? Is this a big deal or not?
That's what I'm going to say. It's not a big deal.
Sunil's laughter is genuine and deep.
All right. So to answer your question, I think that the some of the concerns are over-exaggerated. The sky is not falling. But I think let's talk about what worked out of this law and what didn't work so well. So when it got passed in 2015, I think one of the things I recall from it was the automated information system. Automated indicator system.
AIS, right.
Yeah, AIS. And the premise was, enterprises would basically feed our indicators into that, and somehow we get indicators back from the government on that too. I don't know about you all, but I don't think that was a success. Okay. I don't think it really took off, got off the ground for a lot of reasons.
It was a nice idea. It was a nice idea, right? Don't you think?
I don't know if I would say it was a nice idea, but its heart was in the right place. Bless its heart. Right.
Would you bless that heart? Yeah.
Okay, but that said, I was involved in way back in the day on something called FSARC. It stands for Financial Services Analytics and Resiliency Center, and in the I happened to help spin up the analytics part of it, and one of the things I really wanted to push the needle on was, instead of just sharing indicators, can we share sources and methods? And I'll use that term very explicitly. Can we share sources and methods of how we discover these indicators, not just the indicators themselves? Think of it this way. Let's say I'm baking a cake.
Totally agree.
Me baking the cake is nice, but I'm not giving you the cake. I'm going to eat the cake. And you might get crumbs. Okay. Actually, not even crumbs. You might get the eggshells and the powder left over after I make the cake. What you really want is not, sure, you might want the cake, but you don't really, no one wants the eggshells and the indicators. Because guess what? The attacker has already moved on, built other infrastructure, and the indicators are not as useful. But having the methods of how I discovered the recipe for that cake is probably what is more valuable. But it's also harder to articulate in a standardized format. That was back in 2018, 2017, whatever. But now, guess what? We have this magic called LLMs that can take some of the things that we have and we can say, hey, this is how I discovered it in Splunk. Maybe I can write a query that helps me discover it in Elasticsearch. So the methods by which we share this is more about knowledge sharing and not about information sharing. And so I think that if there's an opportunity to sign a new act, it's not about sharing information as much as moving up this evolution of what we really should be sharing, which is not the indicators and more around, again, I'm going to use the word sources and methods.
Yeah, the techniques. You wanted more about the techniques. Agree. Totally.
And if you look at the Dave Bianco's pyramid of pain, at the very top of that pyramid of pain, you have TTPs. And I think that's really moving up this pyramid, that pyramid, where the indicators that were talked about in this act was really at the bottom part of that pyramid. And it's just not as valuable.
Yeah, so you're, I mean, would you agree then? Meh. It's okay.
No, I don't think it's meh. I think there are some, unfortunately, some other authorities and other sort of things that need to be still put in place, or at least there needs to be somebody on the government side to help facilitate the public-private sort of connection that needs to still happen. I don't think necessarily that this is going to dismantle information sharing, at least not within a private sector, but I think it will create a little bit more of a barrier between public sector and private sector. And there is
wake me up in 2028. Is that what you're saying?
It's going to, or 2027, right?
2027, okay.
But I would also say, for those who are familiar, search on private Project Indigo, and Jerry, I forget if you were involved in that too, but yeah, so Project Indigo was a financial services initiative that I thought was a good, was probably one of the better models at the time of government, private sector sharing. Could have been better, sure, again, but opportunities may not, it'd be harder to execute upon those opportunities without this sort of act in place.
Yeah, I found that, you know, we pushed for that, but people weren't, first of all, it was put on there because people were worried that their lawyers weren't going to let them share threat intel because of the PII in there. And then when there were PII in the threat intel, they'd get in trouble. How we let that narrative run away, I don't even know, because there's no PII in threat intel. And everybody was really paranoid. It was just so stupid. But it was kind of like, okay, well, let's just get this act in and whatever. I don't think that level of sharing would have ever really mattered. And people think this is going to affect peer-to-peer sharing, which is what really pays the bills. And I don't think it will at all. I don't think it'll slow it down. And so that's why I don't think it's going to make that much of a difference. It'd be worse. It might have a negative consequence in that it could have a chilling effect where there was no awareness of sharing. Like, hey, I heard that we're supposed to stop sharing. Do we share? Yeah, we do. Well, stop that. Like, well, but it has nothing. Too late. Maybe some orgs, you know, that'll happen. And in that case, my argument would be maybe we shouldn't have, like, kind of built a house of cards to begin with and false pretenses, but alas.
Yeah, I don't think, to your point, peer-to-peer sharing, it's not like we ever asked the lawyers for permission.
Some right? people did, and they're still waiting.
And I'm sure those people did the right thing. for the good of all. And summarily, it reject or ignored their lawyer, right? Because they know what the right thing is. Or they practice risk management, as we all should. But I think the perspective is, nonetheless, though, if we did get pushback from our attorneys, we would say, hey, look, you know, here's at least an act passed by Congress that we could point to at least alleviate some of that.
Right. Pushback. That's true. Yeah.
But we don't have that act anymore. So.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. We'll see. All right, guys. Well, thanks a lot. I know we've run over a little bit, but as usual, it's fun. Looking forward to next time. I'm going to keep on going on the move the needle thing. Sorry, I just have too much to go through on that. I hope that you guys enjoy it too. But otherwise, I will see you guys pretty soon, and hope you guys have a great weekend.